Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Monday afternoon, at least this afternoon where we are, maybe evening where you are, maybe Tuesday morning where you are. Wherever you are, we're grateful you're with us. Thanks for being with us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and as promised, Paul Gondreau is our guest. He's a professor of theology at Providence College. He wrote a book called The Passions of Christ's Soul in the Theology of St. Thomas Aquinas, and he wrote one of my favorite essays of all time for Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humani Vitae. It's definitely the best essay I've ever read on contraception and the life issues and all that kind of stuff. So I recommend that book to you as well, Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humani Vitae. He's going to be one of the speakers at our conference in September 23rd through 26th out here in San Diego. And the conference is on Jesus. And so today our topic is the maleness of Jesus, Jesus as a man, and in particular, maybe Jesus's own manhood as a critique of the manhood as it is lived in the modern world. You're welcome to call and get involved in the conversation, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Dr. Paul Gondreau, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Cy.
Does it matter that Jesus was a man?
Does it matter that you're a man?
Does it matter? To me, it does, and to my wife, to no one else.
As obvious as the answer is to the question, unfortunately, today's culture does not admit of an obvious answer. At least, if we consider the larger backdrop of this culture of toxic humanity, gender confusion.
Right.
Feminists have accused focus on the maleness of Jesus as having as emptying Christ of his theological totality, and it has his maleness has no theological significance. So the short answer is yes, it matters, but unfortunately we have to argue for it and argue for it strenuously, and that's what I do.
888-318-7884 is the number if you'd like to get in on our conversation with Dr. Paul Gondreau about the maleness of Jesus. 888-318-7884. So let's start with what we teased earlier, toxic masculinity. What does the masculinity of Jesus have to do with or say about what is now called toxic masculinity?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, let's just consider as our sort of representative voice of this perspective or this culture of toxic masculinity, the American Psychological Association, back in 2018, it issued a report, and the title, which speaks for itself, is Harmful Masculinity and Violence. And it names masculine ideals and heterosexism as inherently dangerous.
Wow.
And by masculine ideals and heterosexism, I think we can take that to mean male aggression in all forms, men as protector and providers of the family. We just go down the line. So,
Who was that? That was the American Psychological Association, or?
Yeah, the American Psychological Association.
Wow.
2008. Yeah.
So yeah, there is a way in which the institutions in many cases scientific institutions, but certainly a lot of educational institutions in the humanities and sciences are captured by an ideology that is very suspicious of the male.
Yeah. And suspicious of, let's now call it binary sexuality,
right?
Of male female he created them. Genesis 1:28.
Hate speech,
and how dare you restrict sexuality to these two categories? But the fact is that in Jesus, what the incarnation, and let me just say also that in the theological backdrop is this tendency which Christian tradition has always struggled with, and that is to affirm the full humanity of Christ. The heresy goes by the name of docetism. It comes from the Greek meaning to appear. That is, Christ only appeared to be human, but wasn't really, because we can't have God, after all, entering into the stuff of this world. Well, of course, our faith affirms that indeed, as John 1:14, the Word became flesh, and flesh captures, you know, the whole nature of the human person. But especially John, if John says flesh, it's because there was already a tendency in his day to downplay or deny the humanity of Christ. And so he uses that word flesh. Rather, he could have said man, God became man, and that would have been well and good. But there's something more abstract about the word man compared to the word flesh, sarx in Greek, caro in Latin, from which we get incarnation. And the point here is that to be truly human, then God must be one or the other sex. He must be male or female. And the historical fact of the matter is he was male. So he's fully human in the very measure that he is fully male. Just as a woman, as the Virgin Mother, as the Virgin Mary, is fully human in the very measure that she's fully female. And to back off or to downplay and to any degree Christ's maleness or the Virgin Mary's femaleness, for that matter, is to chip away at their real humanity and at Christ's real humanity in particular.
There is something about him, though, that subverts the usual way of thinking about what it is to be a man. And there is something subversive in his way of his manner of living. He's not a cartoon character. He's not even an Achilles-like hero. You know, he doesn't. His incarnation is very specifically not meeting the Greek ideal of manhood.
Oh, it's super interesting you mentioned the Greek ideal, Cy, because let's consider just for a moment Homer's Iliad. Homer's Iliad sings about, the opening lines of the Iliad says it's going to recount a story about the rage of Achilles.
Yeah.
That is the unhinged, disintegrated Achilles and how his anger got the better of him. Well, the Gospels hold up for us, a man, it sings for us, if you will, to use the language of Homer, it sings of a man of perfect self-mastery and integrated emotion. Now, we might think that, forget for the moment the Gospels, the New Testament. And let's just do a thought experiment. And let's say God has never become man. And let's imagine now God becoming concretely human. And I'd ask you, Cy, can you describe a sort of public ministry of this man? I dare say none of us would portray a man like Jesus.
No.
Was subject to intense emotion. And by the way, anger, do you know that in the Gospels, the emotion that is affirmed the most of Christ, it's not compassion and what otherwise we would think, it's actually anger. You know, so that's why I love the contrast between the rage of Achilles in his unhinged anger and the Christ with his, he's a man of emotion, but it's regulated emotion, it's integrated emotion, it's mastered emotion.
Isn't that wonderful what you just said? Because that's a great thought experiment, because this gives you a sense of our failure to imagine the fullness of our humanity, because we would conceive of it as, if not Achilles, then at least Hector. Hector's a great guy, but he's no Jesus. It's a completely different ideal.
Yeah, that's really well said. I mean, compared to Achilles, Hector is a much better rounded human being, much more balanced human being. But he's no Christ. So to go back to your initial question about how we learn about our fundamental humanity in light of the incarnation, Vatican Council II in Gaudium et Spes number 22 says that Christ fully reveals man to himself. That is, we understand our humanness fully in light of Christ, in light of the incarnation. So we need to turn to him to provide the reset for being human. And because he was a man, a male, for the reset for what it means to be male, fully male, what it means to be a man, just as, you know, the Virgin Mary provides a reset for women to understand what it means to be fully female.
Our number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. What does Christ teach us about what it is to be a man? We will continue to ask that question to our guest, Dr. Paul Gondreau, theology professor from Providence College, right after this. And your calls are welcome, 888-318-7884.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
She is one of the most beloved saints of all time, honored as the saint of the little way.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thérèse of Lisieux entered the Carmelite convent of Lisieux in 1888 and survived only 9 more years. Still, her extraordinary holiness and prayer life prompted her superiors to have her write an autobiography, The Story of a Soul. It became a spiritual classic.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, talking about the maleness of Christ. Christ, what can he teach us about being men, about raising boys to be men? Your calls, your participation, very, very welcome. 888-318-7884. Dr. Gondreau will also be talking at our upcoming Catholic Answers Conference. You can find out about it at CatholicAnswersConference.com. And this is the quality of speaker we're having. This is why you should come, CatholicAnswersConference.com. Will your talk be on this topic, Dr. Gondreau?
It will indeed. It's on Christ's maleness. Yep.
And okay, so let's unpack a little bit more, and then we will go to calls. And there are lines open, 888-318-7884. Maybe you could give me some specifics on what Christ teaches you and me about how to be a man, teaches every mother about what kind of man she is to be raising, teaches every bride about what a man is supposed to be as a husband. What is it we're supposed to learn from Christ about manhood?
That's such a question. You know, so, I mean, first of all, we see that Christ is not the machismo ideal,
no.
You know, that he is subject to emotion. It is not hindered in showing his emotion. You know, just think of the scene at Lazarus's tomb where though he knows he's going to resurrect Lazarus, raise him from the dead, he still weeps. And weeps in the depth of his spirit, so, you know, there's that side of it. But there's again the self-mastery side of it, the integrated side of it. That he doesn't allow these emotions, if he doesn't expunge them from his humanity, nor does he allow them to dictate his actions. And you know, this is what in our moral tradition, this is what we mean by the term virtue or moral virtue. Virtue is to live in a balanced, moderated fashion with respect to these lower animal-like drives that we have towards bodily goods. This is it's exactly what the emotions are expressive of. So there's that side of it. And then, you know, a topic that I really like talking about a lot is how Jesus treats women. Because on the one hand, it's very countercultural to the ancient Judaism of his day, and he risks even to the scandal to treat women in a certain way that he did. On the other hand, he also, he comes down very, very strictly on sexual boundaries, on sexual morality, and the standard that he elevates. In fact, you know, if in the ancient world the law of Moses was already, you know, it expressed a strictness when it came to sexual morality that was unparalleled. In fact, scripture scholars say that this is really one of the defining features of the ancient Israelites was their strict sexual morality in particular. Jesus makes it even stricter. I mean, consider how he does away with the Mosaic permission for divorce. He names, when he condemns lust in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, chapter 5, verses 27 to 28. He calls it adultery of the heart. You know, so this is, you know, strong language, but it shows that hardly is he backing off or taking a lax approach to sexual morality relative to what was already strict in the ancient world. He makes it even stricter. And then you balance that with this way he treated women, which was... it was scandalous. For instance, you know, that in the law of Moses, there were strict laws governing physical contact between men and women. It's what came to be called the laws of the Nagaya. So in short, women and men should have as little contact with each other, physically speaking, as possible, except for married couples. And because ancient Judaism tended to see, and this is in the Talmud, this is the ancient rabbinic commentary on the Old Testament, women were regarded as sexual temptresses, and so it really fell on women to stay out of public, to cover themselves, and it was their fault if they were found to be speaking to a man in public to whom they were not married. So there's, you know, that they were separated in synagogue. They had to stand behind a barrier in the temple in Jerusalem. They were not allowed to come into the inner court. They were not allowed to be disciples of rabbis. They were not considered fit to study the word of God under a rabbi. So here comes Jesus, who not, you know, accepts women as disciples and thus, you know, sends a signal that they are, there is a dignity that women possess by virtue of their humanity, which does indeed make them fit to be full disciples of the Lord. He lets them travel with him. so you got the laws of the Nagaya on the one hand, and Jesus allowing, you know, women to travel with him. Luke chapter 8, verses 1 to 3 names Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Susanna as three, and Luke says, and many, and there were many more.
Yes.
So, you know, it makes you wonder what's going on here with his strict sexual morality and yet his disregard, scandalous for the Jews of his day, disregard of these laws of the Nagaya. And I think the answer to that at least face value conundrum is the virtue of chastity.
Okay, so I want to get to that if I can. And I see callers coming. We're going to get to callers. 888-318-7884 is the number. I do want to ask you about this because sexual prowess is so often considered a mark of real masculinity. The perfect man lives his entire life as a virgin. What is he saying to us living a virginal life?
Yeah, so... now, we know that he didn't choose virginity sort of by default, as if he had a low esteem for marriage. Jesus has the most elevated, highest esteem possible for marriage, and it comes out in his revoking the Mosaic permission for divorce. He affirms the indissoluble union between man and woman. It is a permanent bond, and in affirming, and you know, by revoking the Mosaic permission for divorce, it was only Jewish men who had the right to divorce. So what he was doing was he was revoking the male right for divorce, affirming, therefore, among other things, that men and women are equal in marriage. So he's affirming that marriage is indissoluble. It's expressive of the will of God. What God has joined, let man not put asunder. It involves a partnership between equals. So his virginity, then, indicates is that sex is indeed given to us. It's a gift given by God for the express purpose of marriage, at least in terms of its use. And, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas, he ties in he says, look, if you consider the types of sensual pleasure we experience, pleasures associated with eating and drinking and with sex are the most intense. And he said, it's not by accident. God wires us this way. He designs us this way because eating and drinking is tied to our existence as individuals. If we don't eat and drink, we won't survive as individuals. And sex is tied to the existence of the species, of the human race. Now, we know that not every human being has to procreate in order for the human race to to continue, which leaves the door open to certain individuals to embrace the virtue of virginity, which is the perpetual sacrifice of sexual pleasure for one's entire life for the sake of the kingdom of God, and thus give a powerful witness to the fact that as good and as important as human sexuality is, as marriage is, yet these are lower goods, and it's a good which is proper to this life. We as human beings are ordered to eternal life with God. And so it's extremely important that we have a witness of virginity in particular, and especially in a culture that Pope Benedict once said is characterized by this new philosophy of sexuality, whereby he meant, you know, that nature is irrelevant, that pleasure, sexual pleasure, is an end in itself. So today especially, it's crucial that we have this witness of virginity to show that as beautiful and as wonderful as human sexuality is, it's not expressive of our deepest humanity. It's not expressive of our highest good. We are on the path to a much greater good, and that's the good that's absolute and infinite. That's the good that is God himself.
Dr. Paul Gondreau is our guest. As we've said, he's going to be speaking at our conference September 23rd through 26th here in San Diego. Actually, I should say sunny San Diego, so that you'll be tempted to come. CatholicAnswersConference.com is where you can find out about it. Let's go to the phones, which, by the way, there are some lines open, 888-318-7884. Up next is Kirsten in Idaho Falls, Idaho, listening on EWTN Channel 130, Sirius Satellite Radio. Go ahead, Kirsten, with your question.
Hey, guys. First-time caller, long-time listener, so I'm really excited to be on.
Well, we're happy to have you.
Thank you. So one particular instance that's always infatuated me is when Jesus demonstrated his anger in the temple with the money changers, flipping tables, whipping people. It just seems so out of character. And with someone who is so calmly masculine, I guess, for a way to put it, I was just curious as to what the good doctor's response would be about how that particular instance demonstrated Jesus's masculinity and what we can take from that.
Oh, I love that. Well, Kirsten, you happen to name the very scene in the life of Christ that I chose for the cover of my book on Christ's passions. It's the fresco by Giotto on the expulsion of the money changers from the temple. I would maybe take a little issue with saying that it's out of character. I would argue it's not out of character. If it seems like it's out of character, it's because we've been presented with a false image of the Jesus of the Gospels. When you pay close attention to the textual evidence, we see a man who is very subject to emotion and, you know, to great fear, obviously, in the Garden of Gethsemane. To desire, he expresses desire to share the Last Supper with his apostles. But also, and when you just comb the Gospels, which I in fact did, to just sort of chart all his emotional reactions, the emotion he expresses the most is in fact anger. And this is somewhat of a conundrum if we consider how, at least in our fallen condition, anger is a passion that blinds reason the most. That's what St. Thomas Aquinas says. It's an emotion that can really grab hold of us. So what Jesus teaches us is that, you know, this is part of our human structuring, if you will. So it's not bad to have to be subject to emotions, including anger. In fact, what we see in Jesus, and the moral tradition is very clear in this, Gregory the Great speaks of righteous anger, and the supreme example of righteous anger is Jesus expelling the money changers from the temple. So what we don't have in the Gospels is a pallid, emotionless, stoic Jesus, not by any stretch, which again, if we return to that thought experiment I asked earlier, that if we had to come up with the incarnate God-man and draw a concrete picture of his life, I dare say none of us would. I think most of us would imagine a sort of stoic Jesus who rarely exhibits emotion, certainly not anger, and yet that's not the Jesus of the Gospels. So we come back to the fundamental point that we learn a lesson about what it means to be fully human, that to integrate these lower drives, not to expunge them, not to eradicate them, not to ignore them or deny them, nor to let them dictate our actions. If anger is an emotion that we struggle with, we learn from Jesus how always to keep mastered control of that emotion, even in moments of great intensity. So we must relearn that it's not out of character, it's quite in character. And so let's learn what the character is.
Kirsten, we'll leave it there because you could probably hear the music. 888-318-7884. The masculinity of Jesus is our topic this hour. Is he the antidote to toxic masculinity? Your calls welcome. 888-318-7884. Dr. Paul Gondreau, our guest. 888-318-7884.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cortiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
There can be a fine line between love and hate.
Plan to join us to talk about that tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
On most of these EWTN stations.
Now here's more of Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate you taking the time. This hour, we're talking with Professor Paul Gondreau of Providence College, theology professor at Providence College. I almost moved you north to Boston College there for a second. I don't know why I had that temptation, but
Dominican school to a Jesuit school, also, you know. So that's the bigger faux pas.
One among his works is a book called "The Passions of Christ's Soul in the Theology of Saint Thomas Aquinas," and Christ, the man, he teaches. I mean, I think this is a point that Pope Saint John Paul II made. Several times throughout his long pontificate was that Christ, the great gift that he gives us is not just that he reveals God to us, but he reveals man to us. He reveals to us what it is to be a human being.
Yeah, and he was drawing, John Paul II was drawing upon Gaudium et Spes, the Constitution on the Church in the Modern World from the Second Vatican Council, number 22, that Christ fully reveals man to himself. That's one of my favorite statements from the Second Vatican Council. And, you know, just to recapitulate what we were talking about before the break, you know, that we see Jesus expelling the money changers from the temple. This is rarely the Jesus we think of, you know, when we compare him. You know, he's the compassionate one, the one who doesn't get upset. You know, and but, you know, what we see there is we see I would call an expression of healthy male aggression, that men are structured to be aggressive. You know, we know this in light of, in fact, neuroscience, neurobiology, that we know that the male brain and the female brain are structured differently. So when Genesis 1:28 says male and female, he created them. That just hints at the much grander reality. We are our complementary sexual design reaches to the very structure of the brain, and men are wired to be aggressive in a way that women are not. In terms of sexual drive, men are structured have an orientation to sexual desire and to pleasure in a way that women don't, which means, especially in the fallen condition, that men have a particularly difficult time with lust, at least in a way that women don't. Now, this is, of course, is not to say that women do not struggle with lust at all, but generally speaking, it's more of a male problem. So what the answer is not as our culture would have it, as the American Psychological Association, and again in its 2018 report, Harmful Masculinity, to consider all forms of male aggression to be unhealthy, to be disordered. Mm. No, what we see in Jesus is that men must properly channel their aggression. We are wired to be aggressive, but this is what we learn in light of Jesus is this: if it's complemented with a self-emptying sacrifice of self. And where men, I think men know that between the sexes, between men and women, we know we're the expendable sex. And by that I mean, that when there's danger, men intuitively know they jump in first. If rushing into a burning building, you know, or the ship is sinking, men rush. No, they should rush in first. And men know that they stay on, you know, they're the last to get off the ship. This is not to say, of course, that women are not capable of the same, but that between the two, men know that they are wired to sacrifice themselves. And of course, Jesus is the highest model of that. So it's aggression at the service of others, at the service of our families, at the service of women, at the service of children, at the service of the entire human family. So to provide for our families, to protect our families, to protect each other. This we all learn this in light of Christ's full manhood.
888-3187-884, the number we're talking about, the manhood of Christ, masculinity in the light of Christ, 888-318-7884. There is a way to make a serious mistake, a theological mistake, in the example that Kirsten gave us earlier and that you've been pursuing of Christ throwing the money changers out of the temple. And that's one that our own our former chaplain and very good friend, Father Hugh Barber, points out as humorously sometimes that he remembers being taught in a catechism class at a young age about, well, Jesus probably later regretted that he had let himself get carried away. And Father says, no, 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 that is not at all the case. That this is not an incident. We should never see this as an incident of Christ. Well, he's just like all of us. He loses control sometimes. This is the hard thing for us to maybe grasp about him is he, like you said, he's a man of emotion, but he is utterly and completely not a man subject to emotion. It's entirely his choice how he expresses and follows through on his emotions because he's entirely free. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. So I'll take as my master to follow here, St. Thomas Aquinas. And he talks about the relationship between reason and will are higher faculties in our emotions. He uses the word imperium. It means the power to command. The power to command belongs to reason and will. Now, reason and will don't exercise that power despotically. In the way that, similar to your hand, you know, if you command your hand to pick up a pen, your hand will obey and it will be unable not to obey. But you can't do that with your lower instinctive drives. You know, you can tell them, right. You know, I don't want to desire, you know, this woman, or I don't want to get angry at this, but you might, and you might struggle with it. And so, so when St. Thomas Aquinas talks about virtue and the way that the power to command of our higher rational faculties, how it plays out is the more virtuous we become, the more our lower animal-like instinctive drives participate in what's properly rational. It's kind of like, think of a dog that is so perfectly trained, you can take a walk with a dog without a leash, and even if another dog crosses its path, the dog still it'll stay by the side of its master. It's almost as if the dog is rational, but it's not. It's been trained. And for Thomas Aquinas, that analogy is especially appropriate, even more so. In fact, the analogy falls short because the dog's been trained by some external agent, by its human master. But in us, we are our emotions, our lower animal-like drives are mastered from within, from our own faculty. And so we're not centaurs, you know, where you've got a rational part and then a rational part with a clean line of separation between the two. We're integrated, unified beings. And in the person of moral virtue, one sees what that integration looks like the most. And of course, Christ, Thomas Aquinas likes to call Christ the exemplum virtutis. What he means is the highest model of virtue, of consummate virtue. So that, you know, that priest who, or the catechism, you know, that Jesus regretted. No. I mean, not if, I mean, in this sense, this would be expressive of moral regret. And if Jesus is expressing moral regret, then he's guilty of sin.
Yeah,
but
right.
And again, this is the lesson here. Who would imagine a sinless man to be so deeply, concretely human?
Yes, that's right. And it's a great kind of stamp of approval on our humanity, even though we reject our humanity. We think, well, if I was fully myself, what I would be utterly dispassionate, even disinterested somehow. And Jesus is an utter refutation of that fact. No, if you were fully yourself, you'd be alive and vibrant in ways that you're not now.
Yeah, that's right. The ancient Greek philosophical school of thought goes by the name of Stoicism, said just what you just said, you know, that the person of supreme virtue doesn't show emotion at all. And so the supreme refutation of that is the example of Jesus Christ that we find in the gospel. You can't make this up. I mean, that in its own way bespeaks this historicity. None of us could make this up. It utterly shatters our prejudices, our misconceptions, our biases, our ignorances. And even if you got, you know, against the Stoics, you have an Aristotle, and Thomas Aquinas is drawing deeply upon Aristotle. When it comes to virtue, Aristotle affirms that virtue doesn't ignore our passions, our emotions. It does. It seeks to regulate them. Still, I don't think an Aristotle would, if you presented to him, you know, the hypothetical of a God man. You know,
this wouldn't be it.
What the New Testament provides us with.
Again, 888-3187-884, our number. So all of that having been said, we do experience in the passion of Christ at the end of his life. I mean, Isaiah says he opened not his mouth in his prophecy of the messianic suffering. And I've always thought that's the hardest thing, that he really did go to his death like a sheep to the slaughter. He did not protest. He did not, assert himself in any way. What does this communicate to us about the living as men? This seems so unmanly in a way. You know, like in a superhero movie, it would get just to the point where it seemed like he was going to be broken, and then he would throw off the shackles and, you know, and defeat his enemies. But he does not. He goes as a lamb to the slaughter.
Yeah. Well, it's a good lesson for appreciating the fact that when we're talking about moral exemplarity or modeling moral action, morality is ultimately about concrete actions, and they don't happen in the abstract. You can articulate, and we do, moral principles, but at the end of the day, moral action is about concrete action. And so the example you give is a concrete episode in the life of Jesus. It's specific to the end of his life. It's specific to the will of the Father and how he was to atone for human sin, how he was to save the human race. And remember, you know, Jesus, way back early in his public ministry, when he's in the synagogue at Nazareth, they take him to the brow of the hill to try to throw him off.
Yeah.
He wasn't passive there. He didn't let him do it to him there because it wasn't his time yet. But when we come to the end of his life, he knew it was his hour. That's what John's gospel especially is so strong on the hour of Jesus. He knew that his hour had arrived. He knew that his hour was approaching. It was his hour. So if we can just back up for a second to what I mentioned earlier, how men are wired to use their aggression in a properly ordered way for the sake ultimately of self-sacrifice, of protection and giving for the sake of others. This means that in a way, courage is a sort of characteristic male virtue. Certainly, you know, women need to exhibit courage as well, but with men, and with Jesus in particular, consider just the courage, the manly courage that he exhibits at the beginning of his ministry when he goes to do battle with Satan in the desert. This is incidentally how the fathers of the church, this is how they like to speak of the temptations in the desert, as Jesus going onto the battlefield with Satan. And showing that, incidentally, you know, if the Jews were expecting a Messiah who would do battle with the Romans, and, you know, the Romans are no mean enemy, you know, Jesus shows in the temptations in the desert that, you know, he doesn't come to do battle with the Romans, he comes to do battle with Satan. And I'm sorry, but between the two,
take the Romans. Satan is,
and then at the end of, you know, throughout the whole course of his ministry, but at the end, the courage necessary to follow through with his hour, knowing full well that he was to endure unspeakably horrendous pain, exhibited in the fear that he felt, the real fear. There we see the man of manly courage who does not give in to his fear. Courage, in fact, is the virtue that regulates the passion of fear. Every virtue, every moral virtue has a specific passion that is its, if you will, subject matter. And for courage, it's fear. And no greater fear has any human being who's ever walked the face of the earth been experienced than by Jesus at the Garden of Gethsemane the night before his death. In fact, when he surrenders to the will of the Father and accepts his cup, this is really, you know, that was the great cosmic moment. That's when the fate of humanity, our salvation, that really hung in the balance. Because after that, then it was, I don't want to, you know, of course, I don't wish to belittle the actual passion and suffering and crucifixion, but once he accepted this and overcame his fear in such a manly, courageous way, then of course the rest followed properly. And so this is again how we gain our reset. We as men especially gain their reset, their moral reset, their human reset, their masculine reset in the manhood of Jesus Christ.
Paul Gondreau, our guest, your calls welcome. 888-318-7884. Right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The EWTN home video highlight for July is A Church in Crisis. The church is under attack from within and from without. Through the chaos, Dr. Ralph Martin illuminates the path forward for A Church in Crisis. Order your DVD set at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killa, your host. Our guest is professor of theology at Providence College, Dr. Paul Gondreau. He'll be speaking at our conference. I'm going to go to calls now, and we'll let the callers take it for the rest of the program. But before I do that, I got to let you know that a special sale, that summer sale we're having, is on right now. If you use the promo code TREAT, and I have no idea why they chose the promo code TREAT. I guess treat yourself to some Catholic Answers stuff. Everything, nothing, no except. It's not one of those everything except. No, everything at shop.catholic.com, 25% off. If you use the promo code TREAT. And that includes the very fine book, A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him. Just use that promo code TREAT at shop.catholic.com. We go now to Florida. Hayden in Florida, also listening to EWTN Channel 130 on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You are up next, Hayden. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Paul Gondreau.
Hello. Are there any typically masculine traits that Jesus gained that can be attributed to Saint Joseph?
Were there any masculine traits that Jesus learned from Saint Joseph?
Yes.
Absolutely. I would say now, of course, we don't have concrete evidence of this in the Gospels, but human nature certainly would give an affirmative response. We learn what it means to be the particular sex that we have, that is, we learn what it means to be a man or a woman, most especially from our parent of that same sex. And rightfully so, because, you know, in our Catholic tradition, our sexuality is, you know, it's integral to us as our whole embodied nature is integral to us, and it belongs to us first and foremost because we have an embodied nature. God does not have a sex. The angels are not male and female because they don't have bodies. And the structuring of our sexuality, again, it's not, you know, it reaches to the very design of the brain. And so men are structured to act in a male-specific way. Our brains send male-specific neurotransmitters, and so on. So, the brain, for instance, the male brain is structured especially for speed and direction and motor control. The female brain for color and texture and for memory and so on. You know, these sort of complementary differences. So where do we learn? How does a man learn most especially how to act in a male-specific manner? Well, existentially speaking, concretely speaking, it's from our parents of that same sex. So this is, you know, in this year of Saint Joseph, there's a lot of material there to just give fruitful reflection upon and how Joseph helped Jesus embrace his manhood, helped him to understand what it means to be male, to be a man, and to grow into that, to embrace that, to make it his own, to take ownership of it. It's not something that's alien to us, our sexuality, our sexual identity, male or female. It's not detached from us. It's not alien to us. We must own it. And certainly Jesus would have learned to some extent, at least, and I would say, at least humanly speaking, mostly from Joseph, how to do that.
Does that work for you, Hayden?
It does. Thank you very much.
All right. And I'll just recommend a book from our good friend Joe Heschmeyer, A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times, which covers a great deal of wonderful, interesting details about Joseph from the scriptures for this year of St. Joseph. Thanks, Hayden. I hope we'll get to talk with you again. I got to go to Cincinnati now. Cincinnati, Ohio. I say it like it's a bad thing. I don't mind going to Cincinnati. I get to go to Cincinnati now. Listening on EWTN, Ken in Cincinnati, go ahead with your question for Dr. Paul Gondreau.
Hi, thanks. You got me thinking and wondering, in terms of Jesus's strong and masculine turning over the money changers' tables and because they were accumulating wealth, I wonder if there's a kind of an official church response to the criticism of the church's accumulation of wealth and all the grandeur and all the opulence and gold and, you know, accumulation of money. That a lot of people make a parallel between the church and those
money changers,
religious leaders of Jesus's day, and the church's from strong masculine men, believers, Christians, saying that the church is doing the same thing. Is there an official church response to that criticism?
Well, I would just say we have to be careful to distinguish the. Wealth and how it's displayed properly, and disordered displays of wealth. So, you know, the specific scene of the expulsion of the money changers from the temple, you know, Jesus does not notice. He fully accepts the beauty of the temple itself. It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. Talk about a structure that was grandiose and was built at tremendous cost, but to give glory to God, to raise our spirits to God. What he went after with the money changers is how they were turning that structure that was built to glorify God and to raise our awareness of God. They turned it into an economic exchange place. You know, you've turned my house of prayer into a den of thieves, as he said. So it's not so much the wealth per se. It's how, you know, it's where's the wealth, where is it being channeled, how is it being used, what's the purpose of the wealth, and is it appropriate that then there's nothing wrong with economic exchange in itself. But it is if you're turning a house of worship into a place of economic exchange. So I think it's important that we make those sorts of distinctions, and the church always does when addressing these sorts of issues.
Ken, thank you very much. Of course, everybody's called at the end of the hour, so I got to keep moving to try to get everybody on. Eldon in Silver Spring, Maryland, listening on EWTN. You're up next, Eldon. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Dr. Paul Gondreau.
Doctor, thank you. Curious as to...
Eldon, right into the phone, okay, so we can hear you.
Sorry, is that better?
Yes.
Who died on the cross? God, Jesus, or both the divinity and the human?
All right, Eldon, thank you.
All right, well, you need a full course in Christology to give an adequate answer to that question. In fact, the church took five full centuries to give an intellectually coherent answer to that question. But it's you asked really two questions: who died, and what died? If I ask you who are you, you would answer Sai. But if I ask you what are you? You would give me a different answer, because we all know that there's a difference between what we are and who we are. Who names you is the individual person that you are. What is what you share in common? And so with Jesus, who he is, unlike you or me, he's a divine person. He's the person of the Son. But what is he, unlike you and me? He's two. He's human and divine. So he has two natures united in the one divine person of the Son. So it was a human being who walked, who was born of the Virgin Mary, and who died on the cross. But because that human being was a divine person, we can say, as our tradition always has said, that God was born of the Virgin Mary, and thus the Virgin Mary is the mother of God, that God died on the cross.
Boy, Eldon, that's tough. You know what you can also do is go over to Catholic.com and type in that question, because we've dealt with it many different ways. But as Dr. Gondreau said, Oh, my. We're talking about one of the great mysteries and one in which we have to be very, very careful in our use of language and the distinctions we make. Dr. Paul Gondreau, thank you for all the fine distinctions you made for us and reminding us of the real vibrant and energetic masculinity of Jesus.
Pleasure to be with you. Great to share it.
Yeah, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the conference.
I look forward to it very much.
We told you we're going to have good speakers at the Catholic Answers Conference. Dr. Paul Gondreau will be among them. And he'll be talking about just this subject. If you want to join us, just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. We'd love to see you there, CatholicAnswersConference.com. Join us tomorrow. We'll talk about that new motto proprio from Pope Francis, first hour.